Thank you, Dharma and Cassidy. Good morning, friends. Scripture this morning, as Dharma said, is from Matthew chapter 24, and I'm going to read verses 36 through 44. Matthew 24, 36 through 44. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there will be two men in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and one will be left. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would also have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you also must be ready. For the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Okay, so we'll let the children go downstairs if they want to go. Excuse me, Justin. So I hope everyone had a good Thanksgiving holiday. Plenty of turkey and football. If you eat turkey, if you watch football, or other stuff, if you don't. I eat turkey, but I don't watch football, so. Perhaps you got outside and enjoyed God's creation, as many people are encouraging us to do in these days. That would be definitely a way to express your thankfulness. Today we sang for the second Sunday in a row, because we like this hymn so much, Now Thank We All Our God, and I appreciate the arrangement that Charles composed, and it's great to see him and Sebastian play it together. We do sing this song often, and I think for a good reason. It's a good reminder that thankfulness to God comes not simply on the fourth Thursday of the 11th month of the year and at no other time, but every day. Charles is fond of saying that for him, every day is Thanksgiving Day, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. So while our thankfulness continues, and as it's been expressed in many prayers this morning already, the day of Thanksgiving has passed, and so the feasting is mostly over, and most of the football games have been played, and you've had that nice hike outside if it wasn't raining, it's time to turn our attention to other matters. And no, I don't mean which stores have an extended Black Friday sale through Tuesday, or how much stuff you think you'll be able to get into your virtual shopping cart tomorrow. Today's the beginning of a particular season on the church calendar, the season of Advent, which leads up to Christmas, as Dharma has already mentioned this morning. Now, our tradition, this is the usual disclaimer I have to give whenever I talk about Advent among Quakers, our tradition does not usually pay a lot of attention to the church calendar. We've always been suspicious since our beginnings of holy days, of special holy days. And the reason for that, part of the reason for that, is if you observe special holy days, that might mean that you only have to pay attention to God on those days and do what you like on all the rest. And that's, of course, not what you're supposed to do. Friends have always emphasized the sacramental nature of each day that God has made. So we ask, if it's important to be thankful every day, if we're to strive for the constant realization of God's presence in our lives, then why appoint special times and seasons? So we have some good reasons for not attending to the church calendar, but I usually try and remind us of Advent because I think there is some value in the emphasis on a season of preparation and waiting. And that's the main purpose of this period. Learning to live in expectancy of Christ's coming, or as Jesus puts it in the passage, the coming of the Son of Man. So this passage is the gospel text for the first Sunday in Advent. But I feel like it presents a problem for us. It presents a problem for me anyway. I don't know about the rest of you. Maybe you're all at peace with this. But I'm not. So forgive me. In this part of the Gospel of Matthew, we're not quite at the Passion Week yet, but we're getting close. Jesus has withdrawn from the temple. He's on the Mount of Olives with his disciples. And at the beginning of this chapter, as he's leaving the temple, the folks point out to him, oh, these beautiful buildings and the massive structures. And he says, it's all going to come down. Not one stone is going to be left on another. And then his disciples ask him, tell us, when will these things happen? Some of that meaning, when will the temple fall down? When will the temple be struck down? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And so then Jesus responds with a lengthy series of sayings and parables that this passage that we just read is part of, speaking about the end of the age, or as he puts it, the coming of the Son of Man. So we're in new territory here. At least thus far in Matthew, Jesus hasn't said much about this subject. And the fancy Greek word that theologians use for what Jesus is talking about here is eschatology. The eschaton in Greek means last or final or end. And so eschatology is a concern for last things, things related to the end. And there are several dimensions to this, I think, but the one that Jesus is actually speaking here in part of Jewish tradition that had developed by his time in the first century CE, there was quite a lot of thinking. There was a conviction among Jews that God would decisively intervene to end history and even time itself, or at least fundamentally transform them in some way. That was what was to happen to signify the end, the eschaton, a fundamental transformation of history and time. And early Christians continued in this belief. They heard Jesus speak of it, and it continues in the Gospels, elsewhere in Matthew and other of the Gospels, in some of Paul's letters, and of course in Revelation, the final book of the New Testament, which speaks of God creating a new heaven and a new earth, the new Jerusalem. So here's my problem. Why are we thinking about the end of the age now? It's Advent. We're getting ready for Christmas, right? Isn't this supposed to be a nice time of warm feelings, of peace on earth and goodwill to all that sort of good stuff? Isn't that what Advent's supposed to be about? Who wants to be thinking about the end of all things, of history and even of time itself at this point? I'm going to try and answer that question, but I need to make a little bit of a tangent. Add a little bit more, because I think this understanding is useful for us. There's another fancy theological word related to passages like this one, and the idea of eschatology, of the last things. And that word is apocalypse or apocalypticism. Apocalypticism. And apocalypse is one of those words that I'm sure you've heard. It gets way overused, I think, in today's culture, in the culture of the United States anyway. It often means, in our popular understanding, destruction, disaster, whether natural or human-made, some huge flood or a nuclear war or some kind of plague, right? There's a whole genre of science fiction which is dedicated to what happens after an apocalypse like that. Dystopian fiction, I don't know, it probably didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago, this genre, but it's huge these days. Everybody seems to want to write a book about what happens after the big apocalypse and how people survive and whether they survive. And as words often do when they get overused, it's sometimes used to simply refer to any big event, anything that you want to make a big deal about. Oh, this is going to be apocalyptic, when in fact, no, it's probably not going to be apocalyptic. In fact, And I have to tell a story on my wife here, who's not here today because she works, unfortunately, on Sundays. But she works at the Humane Society, Berkeley Humane Society, helping people adopt cats and dogs. And they're always looking for new ways to promote their services. And they have various events at various times of the year. They take a bunch of animals to a particular place and they sort of, you know, oh, the cute kittens and puppies, don't you want to adopt one? That sort of thing. So they have a number of these big events every year, and they were trying to figure out a new name for the next one that they were going to have, or one that they're going to have sometime next year, I think. And they're sitting in a staff meeting, and they have all these lame ideas. And Stephanie says, of course, well, if you want to use that word, it needs to be apocalypse, obviously. Apocalypse. There you go. So this word gets used a lot of ways, many of which don't really relate to its original meaning. Because the word simply means to reveal or to unveil, to take the veil off of something so that it can be clearly seen, clearly understood. So the reason that the last book in the New Testament is called Revelation is that in Greek it actually is apokalypton, which simply means unveiling. Or revelation. And that's what John documents in that book. God's decisive unveiling of ultimate purpose, of ultimate destination for humanity. So if apocalypse means unveiling or revelation, and it specifically refers to the way that God unveils or reveals things, that means there are all sorts of other apocalypses going on. They're not the decisive apocalypse of the end of time. But think about how God operates throughout the Bible. There are apocalypses going on all over the place. He reveals himself. He reveals himself to Abraham. He reveals himself to Moses. He speaks to them. He speaks to people all through the New Testament. He speaks to Jesus, to Paul, to Peter. So many of these are apocalypses simply because they are an unveiling of God's will for the people that we read about in the Bible. Think also about our present age. Many things are being unveiled around us all the time. Some of these things are of God and some of them are not. Some of them come, I think, from God's action and some of them don't. But nonetheless, there are apocalypses going on all the time. The story of Jesus' birth, as much as we sometimes think of it in a kind of sentimental way or romantic way, is nevertheless an apocalyptic story. The coming of Christ as a child was itself an apocalypse, a revelation. The incarnation of God in humanity revealed God's love for humanity, God's will for humanity, revealed God's willingness to endure all for humanity, for each one of us. That was an apocalypse, and that's why we begin Advent with a passage like this. This passage speaks of the coming of the Son of Man in a future time, or so it seems to, but it also reminds us that the coming of Christ as a child was an apocalyptic event, one that changed the course of humanity decisively. Now, one of the problems that we often have with eschatology is precisely what Jesus begins today's passage with, the question of timing. He says, of that day and hour no one knows, yet not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father alone. Nevertheless, some Christians spend an enormous amount of energy and time trying to figure out when the future apocalypse, when the eschaton is going to come. All sorts of charts and calendars and cross-referencing of Scripture. And I have never, to date, seen it come to fruition. So that takes a lot of effort for some of us, for some people in the church. I don't think any of you are particularly concerned with that, but for lots of folks in the church, it's become an obsession. On the other hand, Some say, well, obviously the early church expected the coming of the Son of Man in their own lifetimes or very soon after. And that didn't happen. So it's probably never going to happen the way that the early church thought it would. So what difference does it make to us? Those are sort of two ends of the scale, maybe. In our own tradition, there's another way to look at it. Friends emphasize the inward operation of the light of Christ in the heart of each person. And this, remember, is an apocalyptic event, an unveiling, a revelation. If we respond to what God is doing within us by means of the light of Christ, it transforms our entire life, our entire lives, our relationships, our priorities, the way that we understand who we are and who other people are. All of that is transformed in this inward revelation, inward apocalypse. So for friends, the end of things, the eschaton, is an end that happens in our own hearts. The coming of the Son of Man is not a future event that we can't know the schedule for. It is now, and it is taking place within each one of us if we will yield to that action of God, that unveiling of God's will for us. I want to say one more thing about the text, which is just to emphasize Jesus' counsel in verses 42 and 44. Be alert and be ready, he says. You don't know the time of the coming of the Son of Man, so be alert. By the same token, none of us knows exactly when God is going to convict us of something inwardly or speak to us in a new way. So we need to be ready for that. Being alert and being ready is good counsel, I think, in any season, but it's especially important for us now as we think about what's going on outside of the doors of our meeting house and trying to respond to what is going on, to what we see happening around us. I, as a white man, cannot claim anything about the Black Lives Matter movement other than to say that I appreciate the saying that has developed among many activists in that movement: stay woke. The counsel there is very similar to what Jesus counsels here. Don't try and insulate yourself from what is going on. Don't try and anesthetize yourself to the pain of others. But stay awake. Stay alert. Things are being revealed around us all the time. Ugly stuff. This election especially. And what's happening now since the election. There's plenty of more ugly stuff coming down the pike. So the challenge for us is to keep awake to the things that are being revealed to us around us in the present age and also inwardly. For as you've heard me say plenty of times before, if we're going to engage in meaningful outward action, we have to base that. That has to rest upon what God is doing inwardly in each of our hearts. So the challenge is to keep ourselves open, yet with patience, knowing that we must yet wait to see justice done, to see racism and hatred extinguished, to see the light of Christ outshining the darkness. We trust that we will yet see these things, for we trust in God's goodness and in God's desire to reconcile all things. And so we must stay awake to how God is doing that in our hearts and around us in the world.